Welcome to this service for Norwich. The next stop will be Chelmsford.
You're listening to The Full English, the show that sees the world through food. And this episode is all about why Costa is Britain's favourite coffee shop. I'm Lewis Bassett. My co-presenter on this episode is Gemma Greenwood. And as always, Forrest DLG does the mixing and the sound design. So, where are we, Gemma?
Sunny Chelmsford.
It's very sunny. And why are we here?
We're on the hunt to find the 25 Costa coffee outlets in Chelmsford.
Which shouldn't be that difficult because, I mean, I don't know if we'll find all 25, but...
Chelmsford has the most Costa coffees per people. I think there's 4,000 people to every Costa.
So they've got the highest density of Costas in the known universe.
Oh, yes. We have officially spotted our first Costa.
Costa pronto in the station.
Yeah, I have Costa most days.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you love about Costa? I think it's a taste. Thank you. And I think obviously, yes, thank you. And obviously it's like the availability everywhere is Costa.
I feel like we're on a treasure hunt here. And the treasure is Costa coffee.
We're not using Google Maps, we're just... Oh my God.
There's a Cafe Nero. That. There's a cafe. There's a Pret. It's coming.
There's a it's Costa. Coming. It's right behind. Okay, so we're on Costa number two.
I just like it, and you get, I like flat white, and you get a bigger cup here than, even though it's small, on and other places, and I just think it's a really nice coffee.
I've got typical Costas around town that will go in maybe 3 or 4 times a week. I just like their drinks and their food better than some of the other coffee shops.
Okay.
And they just come in, so I just like the ambience of it, really.
Yeah.
Friendly staff, et cetera, really. Yeah. People at Jilts would decide what they want, and it's Costa.
Is that...
Is it?
It can't be.
It has to be.
It can't be. And it is.
Okay, Costa number three.
Costa number three is quite highbrow.
It's how many minutes would you say from the previous Costa number two?
Four.
4 minute walk from Costa number two. This one's huge.
I think it's quite relaxed, quite informal, and it's not too loud as well. So it's easy to get a space and work.
Good environment. Yeah. Do you like Costa coffee?
Yes.
Yeah?
Definitely.
Yes. What is it about Costa coffee that you like?
The taste,
the
presentation with the little stars on the top.
Little stars.
Yes,
they do a good cup, and it's like a boat, really.
Yeah, that's size a big cup.
It is.
Do you think that's one of the reasons you like coming to Costa? Because you kind of get your money's worth as well.
Well, you do, really. I mean, it is huge, isn't it?
It's nice here.
Yeah.
All right, Costa number four.
When they first started, everybody used to say, "Oh, costs a lot." They don't, and they're cheaper than some.
Well, according to this tray, Costa is the home of irresistible coffee.
Irresistible is italicized.
I could resist this, to be honest.
Because it's not the same. You have to go out, meet and enjoy. I meet friends here. I meet family here.
You know what you're getting.
Yeah.
And they are absolutely everywhere. I quite like McDonald's coffee, but this is a nicer environment than McDonald's. So, yeah, it's just a combination of those things, really.
Yeah.
Okay, this is Costa number five.
It's gone insane.
Costa number five. Costa number six is only 1 minute away. You've had too much sugar. I've had too much coffee. My pupils are dilated. Wait, you can't. You're going down.
You're going down the up. You're going down the up.
You've had too much sugar, mate. Oh, I'm coming down. We're back in the studio. It's me and Gemma Greenwood again, who is becoming more and more a regular guest, a co-presenter, I should say.
Woohoo!
On The Full English. How are you doing, Gemma?
I'm good, thanks.
Yeah, how's the kombucha?
Yeah, Lewis gave me kombucha. It's smoky, like bacon, but yeah, not.
You said, well, I can taste the bacon. I was like, you don't, it's not a fun, I wouldn't feed
bacon.
To a vegan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's just smoked tea. But that's not what this episode is about. This episode is about, as you already know, is about Costa Coffee. And we were just in Chelmsford. You heard there some of the people that we spoke to. And we went on a Costa crawl, effectively. Not a pub crawl, a Costa crawl.
We had so much Costa.
It was too much. I'm still buzzing now. Several days later. I said we should style this out and pretend that we've just come off the train and just walked into
into
the studio, but it's actually a couple of days later. But what do you remember of that visit? How what did you learn? What did we learn?
Lewis is buzzed, and people like Costa for a variety of reasons. I would say, namely, location. They're everywhere.
Yeah.
The reason why we went to Chelmsford, obviously, 25 outlets. Also, people like value for money. They get a lot of milk.
And the point of this show is basically just like why we want to get to the bottom of why Britain is so in love with Costa Coffee.
Well, can we start with what your statement in question was?
Go for it.
So Lewis's, what he put to me was that Costa Coffee is, quote, bloody awful. So how and why is it the UK's most popular coffee house?
Is it the, so let's
took
let's,
that and run with it.
Let's start, you know, as you know, when it goes, if you go to university, they say you need to really think about the question before you do the answer. You have to define your terms. So what do we mean by it's the most popular coffee house?
So this year, Costa Coffee were voted the nation's favourite coffee shop for the 13th year in a row.
Wow.
Yeah, that's madness.
I didn't know it was that often. They hold what? They just do like a polling?
Well, the thing is, I kind of feel a little bit wary about it. because it was basically World Coffee Portal, I think, ran a survey.
Uh-huh.
And they say on the website, they refer to the vote as being for consumers' favourite branded coffee shop chain.
Mm-hmm.
The survey was carried out with more than 5,000 UK consumers. But obviously there is something in the fact that it was a brand, perhaps, as opposed to maybe a small or local coffee shop.
Mm. Gemma, if you haven't already noticed, is our resident expert now on Costa. She used to be our resident expert on Weatherspoons, and God knows what you'll be a resident expert on.
I'm also very talented.
It's true. It's true. But I mean, whatever, like the survey says people love Costa, but the numbers don't lie in terms of how big a chain they are, right? Do you know how many shops they have?
In terms of outlets in the UK, Costa have 2,792 outlets, as opposed to Greggs, which is another now popular place to get your coffee, which is second, 2,176. Or in kind of more relevant coffee terms, Starbucks has 1,089 outlets in the UK.
So they've got like 1,000 more stores than Starbucks, their nearest rival, and pretty much 600 more stores than Greggs.
Yeah. I mean, Starbucks is non-British. They're the biggest coffee house in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But in the UK, Costa's bigger.
Well, Costa is now owned by Coke, right? Coca-Cola.
Yeah, Coca-Cola.
Which we'll get onto. I also looked this up. I saw that it was 2,700. And what did you say? You had a precise number.
Of course, 2,792.
And we've been to about 8 of those, just in Chelmsford alone. And that's brick and mortar, their stores.
That is.
Because they have 12,700 machines. Like, there's one in the local shop nearby. Yeah, you know what? I got this data from your
from my research. I know, I was going to say.
I'm plagiarising you. Yeah, okay.
You can reference me in the show notes.
Thanks, I will. So they're popular in terms of when people are asked effectively in these big surveys, what's your favourite high street chain for coffee? People say Costa. And they're popular in terms of just the numbers. There's that many stores.
Yeah, and in terms of turnover. So to give you kind of some comparative stats in terms of money,
mm-hmm.
Costa do, I don't know what the best way to say this is, because rather than being precise, you know what, I'm going to lead up to it. So in third place, Starbucks generate £361.7 million.
That's turnover.
That's turnover per year in the UK. Cafe Nero generate £366 million. So kind of similar to Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
How much, you know what, I'm going to turn this on you now.
Oh no, this is like the stakes from episode. I'm going to say double. 700.
You're wrong. I'm taking such joy in that. Basically, Costa generate £880.59 million, pounds, which means that they generate over two times as much as their competitors.
They are smashing it.
They are, what do you say? What's that word? Behemoth. No, that's not.
Behemoth.
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 We're going to take this bit out.
They are big. They're huge, man. They are. That's, so this is the puzzle, listeners. So we did a little survey on our Instagram and we asked people, what do you think about Costa Coffee? Would you go there? Would you not go there? Or would you only go there if there's literally nowhere else to go? And overwhelmingly, we got like more than 100 responses and overwhelmingly people were saying, I would never go there. I would only go there if I had to. They were the responses. But that's because you guys, probably like me,
niche audience.
Yeah, you're a niche audience. We're all kind of a bit, you know, food snobby or something and we don't like these places. We all probably go to our, you know, independent coffee shop, as well we should. So for you, maybe it's not the case for those people who are being polled and being like, yeah, I love Costa, it's obviously the best one. But for our listeners, it sounds like it's a puzzle for us. Why is it the most popular?
I used to like Costa Coffee until I visited 10,000 of them. And I think it's because they kind of felt familiar. They didn't feel pretentious. You know, if I think about my own Costa experiences before now, you know, it was going to Golders Green near to where my grandma lived on the high street. It was like going to visit my sister in Liverpool and, you know, first visit to Costco and then, we're in the retail park. We'll go and get Costa coffee. We like our drinks milky.
Yeah.
That's what we do. And, you know, thinking that it's quite cheap, it's not overly fancy. It felt like an accessible space. Overthinking about it.
Yeah. Well, you've given us the answer there. So we've finished the show there.
Podcast over.
No, there's much more to be said, guys. Let's go into the history then. So, I mean, where did Costa come from? Gemma, you being our resident expert.
Okay. So Costa was founded by two brothers, Sergio and Bruno Costa. They're actually from Italy, which is quite rare, it seems, in the coffee chain space these days. So Starbucks is American. I believe Cafe Nero actually also was founded by an American, but Costa actually has its roots in Italy. So Sergio and Bruno Costa, they moved with their family to the UK from Parma in about 1959.
Hold on a second. You know how in Weatherspoons we did the prehistory and we put the Hovis music behind it?
Yes.
I'm going to get Forrest DLG to stick some, what would be the equivalent? Forrest, you've got license here to put some music behind this bit. Back to you, Gemma.
Your creative magic.
Sorry to interrupt.
They moved in 1959. It was a time when in the UK there were a number of significant social changes happening. So the UK was welcoming immigrants from former colonies and Commonwealth countries, which is interesting because actually I feel in a way that Costa's story is a little bit about like a story of immigration in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
The Costa family brought a traditional coffee bean drum roaster with them. Legend has it is that their dad basically he said that they could forego a lot of their other personal belongings in place of this drum roaster, and that would really be seen as the starting point for the family's future business. Later in 1971, the brothers opened their wholesale coffee operation. And at the time, it was supplying roasted coffee to local caterers and specialist Italian coffee shops.
So they were mainly supplying. So I know that he used to, one of the Costa founders used to take a black cab around London and deliver coffee like to the Ritz and stuff.
Yeah, you're jumping ahead to what Costa being fancy.
Okay, so it had much more humble roots before they got to the Ritz.
Yeah, basically, they'd grown enough demand to expand their premises in South London. By the time that they'd opened their first shop in 1981, they'd carved out a reputation for a touch of class.
A touch of class?
A touch of class.
That was your words, Jenny. Are you reading from the Costa website?
No, that's genuinely what it is.
Was a touch of class. Okay.
I mean, as you said, so deliveries to their retailers were made using iconic black cabs.
Uh-huh.
Classy.
Nice, yeah.
And in-store, which actually from their website, they describe as their first coffee boutique. Which, again, thinking about the language, drinks were served in porcelain cups, which was a first for London coffee sellers. That is a touch of class. And I think it's about coffee really being seen as something that was cosmopolitan. It was coming over from the rest of Europe and Italy. And I think that kind of cemented it. It's not as we see it now. Mm. And by the time they'd kind of established their shop, they had then begun expanding their business and they began opening more shops across prestigious locations in London. And by 1995, they'd expanded to 41 shops And it was at that time the that they were then, comes yeah, in. Then okay. sold to Whitbread.
But yeah, you've given us a pretty good potted overview there, but it's all pretty rapid. It all happens quite quickly. So they go from basically having shops in the 80s to selling to Whitbread in 1995, you just said?
Yeah, 1995.
And my understanding is that the reason that Whitbread bought in to buying Costa, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, Gemma, was that Whitbread were known as a ginormous brewery with, I think it was something like 6,000 pubs at the time in the mid-80s. And because of monopoly legislation, i.e. like the government stepped in to basically say, you guys own too many pubs, you've been too successful. Whitbread had to sell like 2,000 of those pubs, like a third of their pubs. And they needed to diversify, which is actually kind of similar to how Coke ended up acquiring Costa from Whitbread. So Whitbread, this ginormous brewery, said, we can't just keep selling beer. We're not even allowed to keep selling beer. Let's start selling some coffee instead. So they buy Costa in 1995. And what happens then?
Business boomed.
1995 is the boom years. So the mid-90s, you know, to all you Zoomers listening, you know,
oh
drinking.
God.
Well, does that sound like too old? Am I,
Lewis is older than me. I should probably put that out there.
Right, okay, fine. Yeah. Well, Gemma, let me tell you, coffee wasn't always a thing, you know. You couldn't always just roll into your high street local coffee shop or artisanal
coffees.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this is new. This is really new. And really, the 90s is when it got going, right?
Well, I think with that boom, it was that cafe culture became important to people's lives. And we already know that coffee houses throughout history have been places where people could meet. People often, you know, intellectuals would go and have debates and discussions. But in the 90s, all the big brands, you know, Starbucks and Costa and Cafe Nero were bringing it to the masses. In turn, it probably made us more interested in coffee. You know, what our particular order is, how the production of it is made, you know, the people behind it, which is ironic, really, because nowadays, you know, the more specialist we become about coffee, or, you know, the more specialised we want our knowledge to be, we're actually moving away from high street chains, which don't seem to fit with those values.
It's just funny because we think of the high street brands as undermining the independent stores, mm-hmm. right? So there was a case, I think, where Costa wanted to move into Totnes and there was loads of resistance to it because there was a bunch of... Totnes is a kind of like quite hippie town in the south west of England, and they have loads of independent stores and stuff, loads of independent coffee shops. And the local community, or some people in the local community, including the business owners, were opposing Costa, and Costa in the end didn't go there. So there's this kind of framework in which independent shops are meant to be like antagonistic against the big high street chains. Mm-hmm. But in a way, the high street chains are kind of responsible for making coffee popular again.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day, you know, from what I've seen anyway, good coffee wasn't really available. And it's really only through these chains that it's become accessible to us. To kind of carve that interest in specialty coffee. But I think what's interesting, though, about Whitbread's acquisition, and it was obviously a diversification to their portfolio, but it's also part of what made Costa such a success. Mm-hmm. So obviously, if they've already expanded to 41 shops and they've sold themselves to Whitbread for 90 million, they're doing okay. They're doing okay. But it was really about the distribution, I think, through Whitbread that added to their success. So you're already starting to see how it goes through these different channels. So this included Brewers' Fair, which is a string of family-friendly pub restaurants, and also Beefeater, which is a steak restaurant chain. Whitbread also own Premier Inn, which is the biggest hotel chain in the UK. They also, in 2008, acquired Coffee Nation, which was a chain of coffee machines, which you already mentioned about the number of them across the country. These machines became Costa Express, and they were intended to be placed within hospitals, universities, transport hubs, etc.
Yeah, it was like, it's a bit like Greg's. They just had a moment of like aggressive expansion.
Yeah.
And then now they've just found themselves everywhere. When we were also asking about Costa on Instagram, someone messaged us to say that the problem is that they're everywhere, and now they have a kind of monopoly on loads of public spaces. Like you said, like she said, she was going to visit someone in a hospital very often, And there was a Costa in the hospital. It was the only place to get coffee from, and it's really expensive. We'll come on to the Costa in a minute. But like, yeah, they just dominate every like nook and cranny of our cities and towns and our social built environment. Yeah. But one last thing about this, like, so it's my understanding that in 2007 was really like a boom year for Costa. So just before the crisis, although the crisis, I'm not sure even affected like high street coffee retailers that much anyway. Different story. But in 2007, one of their managers of Costa, one of the Whitbread guys, this guy called Jim Slater, comes up with this campaign to show that people like Costa more than Starbucks. So that's their nearest rival. And they do a taste test with like 5,000 people. Do you know this, the campaign?
No, but this sounds a lot like that survey from the beginning. It's just a very long 13-year marketing.
They love surveys, Costa, yeah. But yeah, so they do this, and they basically find that people, when they offer them like cappuccinos, prefer Costa's cappuccino to Starbucks' cappuccino. And so they start this advertising campaign being like, sorry, Starbucks, Britain has chosen, Britain prefers Costa. Wow. It's like a really straightforward campaign. And I think that's the moment in which like kind of Costa really cements itself in the British psyche and becomes like, you know, seen as one of our favorite brands. But how do we get from there to Coca-Cola taking over, and when did that happen?
So in 2018, it was announced that Coke would basically buy the brand as a way for them to expand into the hot beverage segment. And as I said before, it was really seeing the prospects of Costa Coffee as a worldwide brand.
Mm.
It reportedly cost $5.1 billion, if that's an indication again of how successful Costa is. And according to Forbes that year, part of Costa's appeal was its strong expertise across the coffee supply chain, which includes sourcing, vending, distribution, etc., as well as a new roaster, which I think they had in Basildon, in Essex, which allowed for significant roasting capacity in the future, which I think it really kind of tells us about their, well, one, it kind of goes back to their roots about them having the knowledge, them having the means and the resources and the distribution, and also just about their capacity, the fact that they can do it on such a big scale.
That they're fucking huge.
Huge.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that I was thinking about that is it's really similar to why Whitbread ended up taking on Costa, because Coke now has this problem where more and more people are realizing there's a link between sugar consumption and obesity, and fizzy drinks might not be the future. Right?
No way.
Well, I still like a Coke on occasion with a hangover and so on a hot day. I don't know. But yeah, so Coke is starting to realize maybe we should diversify into really milky coffees. And they're the ones who are really pushing the thing in China, which is like seen for them, as it's seen for Starbucks, as a huge potential market.
Yeah.
I mean, also, as you were saying before as well, Costa doesn't just have bricks and mortar. I was just like talking about the machines, but it also offers like home. What was, you had this acronym for it. What was it?
RTD, ready to drink. And actually that's to do with Coca-Cola, right, which I didn't realise. So yeah, Costa Coffee have branded products that are available for home and on the go, which as I say is RTD. Look at that lingo. So at-home products include ground coffee, pods, beans and instant. They also have hot chocolate. And then the RTD products, Lewis is enjoying this part, include canned lattes and flat whites, bottled ranges, which are like frappes, lattes. They all come in different sizes. And they launched, I believe, in 2019, which is after Coca-Cola bought Costa Coffee. Right. And that was really because Coca-Cola had experience in the ready-to-drink sector.
They've just found their way. So I was just saying how they found their way into all of our urban spaces or whatever, and not just urban spaces, motorways, middle of nowhere towns or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also in our fridges and on our shelves in our cupboards and stuff. Like, it's a 360 brand now, right?
It's 360, and I think if we think about the types of products that they're offering now as well, it's also targeting different areas of the market, so a younger drinker perhaps. So if we think about coffee and people who drink coffee, we would usually think of it as an adult drink, a sophisticated drink.
Mm-hmm.
But what businesses such as Costa Coffee are doing, obviously Starbucks, really at the front of the pack as well, are actually fostering custom from a younger drinker by having these milky drinks, by having them in kind of not cool packaging, I wouldn't say. but it's kind of almost a teen drink. It's like buying a milkshake from the supermarket. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about the products, actually, because, I mean, one of the things I really took away from a trip to Chelmsford was just like, because I'm not a regular, as you would have guessed, I'm not a regular frequenter of Costa Coffee. And the thing I took away was just like how big a Costa Coffee is, like, and how much milk. Yeah, there is. What were you going to say?
It was that someone referred to it that they had a soup bowl of coffee.
Yeah, exactly. That, and the few people that we spoke to, as you would have just heard, thought that one of the USPs, one of the reasons they loved it, was because it's value for money, because you get such a big coffee. I mean, I know also that, like, they really do pride themselves on having a really good product, right? They put a lot of effort into it. They have this geezer called Gennaro. How did you pronounce his name?
Gennaro.
Pellicchia. Yeah. And I don't have it written down somewhere, but I know that they insured his taste buds.
£10 million.
£10 million. That's crazy. I did some comparisons, and now I'm gonna do a quiz of you. Maybe you already know the answers. David Beckham's legs were insured.
Ooh, I don't know. I just know that Mariah Carey has really high value legs.
Oh yeah, how much?
I don't know.
Wait, how much was Giordano's again?
£10 million.
Okay. So Giordano's was 10. David Beckham's legs insured for $40 million.
Okay, I was going to say $50 million. So
yeah, not bad. Do you know who Egon Rennie was?
No.
He's a really famous or really important kind of food critic, restaurateur. He had his taste buds insured. This is the 60s, bear in mind. I'm not adjusting for inflation. How much?
And is it higher or lower? Can I have that?
It's lower.
Okay. $2 million.
Much lower because it's
£200.
What? 250. 250,000.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, Bruce Springsteen's voice, last one.
$30 million.
No, man.
$100 million.
3.5 million.
What?
Yeah, so.
Doing him a disservice.
So the geezer at Costa is worth more than Bruce Springsteen's voice. So take that, the boss.
Yeah, but apparently he has to avoid food that's too hot in case he burns his tongue. And he's not allowed to eat curry within 2 days of a tasting session.
Wow. So they take this stuff really seriously.
Really seriously. I mean, obviously, you know, it's big for marketing, but taste is really important to Costa. The fact that they blind tested it as well.
That's why they pay so much for this guy to always make it taste
the same. It's really about their taste.
Yeah. People still love consistency, right?
People love consistency.
Like if you, when you ask people like, why do you go to Costa, or even why might you go to McDonald's? It's like, because you know what you're going to get. Same with Weatherspoons, same with Greg's.
But I don't know, because do people think, I think that's what I was finding really difficult to answer was, I mean, I don't think of Costa as a premium product. Like you think of Cafe Nero, you know, it's a little bit futuristic. It feels more Italian, you know, it's darker.
Wait, Cafe Nero feels futuristic. How so?
Their branding. It's a little bit rocket spaceshipified.
Oh, really? I always think of it as like kind of like Mussolini chic.
Yeah, exactly. But at some point, it would have been
futuristic.
Futurist
kind of. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. I'm
Italian
with you. Modernist
futurist,
kind of thing. Yeah, okay, right.
But, you know, it's a bit like dim lighting. You've got the cool blue.
Sure.
You get a chocolate covered coffee bean. Delicious, by the way. but to me, that feels, at least in the coffee chain space, like it would be more premium.
It's classy.
But Costa apparently play up the fact that their coffee is premium. Or at least is like this quality product.
We might be the wrong people to assess this, but yeah, to me, it doesn't really feel very premium. It feels like run-of-the-mill. It's like the McDonald's of coffee. But I don't know, people love it.
Do they love it, or is it that it's just good enough?
You're listening to The Full English. And if you like this show, then please share it. If you want to ensure we keep making episodes, then go to patreon.com/fullenglish and subscribe. So earlier today, we also spoke to a guy called Jonathan Morris. Jonathan Morris is an academic based at the University of Hertfordshire. And he also makes a podcast, which is called Gemma.
A History of Coffee.
Pretty straightforward name, isn't it? But it's a great show. Am I right? Jonathan Morris's show, History of Coffee, worth listening to because this is not really an episode about the history of coffee, which, as people will know, has a really interesting history in this country. It's connected to radicalism, you know. The Enlightenment, people would call it, about, you know, the empowerment of the middle classes and various other things besides, including slavery and revolution, everything. But you asked Jonathan a really interesting question, which was...
It was basically why tea has such a strong association to British identity and coffee still doesn't have it, despite, as we've seen, the popularity of it in this country.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Part of the appeal of coffee in the 90s was exactly that it wasn't part of British heritage. The Italian style makes it sound sophisticated. The American thing is obviously, you know, that's the cutting edge of sort of Western culture, for want of a better word. So I think that actually it's the fact that it's non-British helps in that period. Tea obviously has got, you know, I mean, we're talking 200 years, aren't we? 1750 to 1950, in which it's pretty much unchallenged. So it's obviously sort of kind of embedded in the British psyche, and a lot of stuff has been written or has been kind of absorbed culturally about that. You know, people would always think of the British as the kind of race that whenever they had to do anything, George Orwell was famous about, you know, the British didn't have a revolution because they would always sit down and just have tea together instead. You know, that's kind of the way that we get rid of our emotions. And that sort of is kind of an embedded culture, I think, for the British. It does connect to also, as you suggested, those sort of notions of tea also being closely tied to the empire. So I think that all of those things come into that identification with tea. What is interesting about it is that it's the reverse of most of what happens on the continent. So on the continent, it is coffee that becomes the kind of the, almost like the domesticated drink, and tea that remains more exotic. If you're in Italy, you know, coffee is coffee, but tea is something quite unusual. I'm always struck. I had an occasion, I went to, I guess it was a tea shop in France, and it was beautiful, you know, it's beautiful with many different kinds of tea or whatever. And the woman said, oh, you're so lucky, the proprietor. You're so lucky because you come from a country with a wonderful tea culture. But actually, we don't have a wonderful tea culture. What we have is a mass tea culture. Yeah. I mean, it's not like we have a population that are great aficionados and connoisseurs of tea. It's that we all, like, you know how to make builder's tea or whatever. So I think we get that very much sense of tea being part of what you might call the banal identity of the British, the day-to-day identity. And again, as I say, actually, I think that's part of the reason why coffee becomes appealing, because it's not part of that day-to-day identity. It's not it's repackaged, if you like, in that sort of post-90s period as something that is a premium good, not a mundane good.
So yeah, like coffee is like the sophisticated thing that we do in the third space, which is a term that I know like CEOs of Starbucks and Costa love using.
Well, that's right. But also this whole third space is a changing third space, which fits quite well with the time, because, you know, if you were to think of whatever Britain's traditional third space is, it's the pub, isn't it? Yeah. But this sort of modern version of the third space is very different because it works during the day. It works for different constituencies. So certainly in that early period, the fact that, you know, coffee shops were a lot more friendlier for essentially for women to meet. They were a lot more friendlier for basically anybody who didn't particularly want to be drinking alcohol to meet. When you then tie that to what happened with society, so the rise of computer, the laptop computer, the kind of more mobile society, the ability to use the coffee shop as a place to have your office meetings, the ability to use the coffee shop as a place to work. And that also fitted, to go back into the other great advantage of the coffee shop and one which Costa certainly has traded on, you know, the coffee shop becomes a place to go and you take 20 minutes, 30 minutes of time and you buy that through your coffee.
Yeah, I thought that was super interesting because in a way what he's saying there is that, yeah, because tea is the banal drink that everyone drinks at home, whatever, and coffee is like the special drink. And it's this kind of place of ritual. It's the place that we go to in our busy, rushed, anxious lives where we get to like sit down and enjoy. Like, I know that when we were doing those Vox Pops, some of the people we were meeting were sat there, you know, studying on their laptops, but lots of people were there just like having a moment, right?
Yeah.
Like checking in with each other. Like
having a chat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's the kind of space of conviviality that we often talk about on this podcast, you know, places like cafes and stuff.
and Wetherspoons.
Yeah, but people maybe underappreciate that Costa is the leading third space in this country, effectively, right? When we use this word third space.
Maybe that's what we're doing. We're compiling a list of the most important social spaces in the UK. But I do think that's important because if you think about coffee nowadays, especially in London, it's a little bit daunting, you know? I'm an ex-art student and I shouldn't be daunted. I'm one of these people. I go to these places. Yeah. But actually Costa, for me, as I said at the beginning, is still just, it doesn't have that same level of intimidation. I don't need to know about where my beans come from. I went to North London once, I think near Notting Hill. Yeah. And they asked me what beans I wanted. I didn't know.
I was like, baked beans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bollocky.
There's a really good article. It's quite old now. It's in The Guardian by a woman called Natalie Ola. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And from memory, I think she's saying that Cafe Nero is a place that makes us feel a bit like uncomfortable because it's like too sophisticated and it's too serious.
I'm a pleb. That's what I would like to
exactly.
say.
Exactly. So I'm at home in Cafe Nero, whereas you, as we well know, you bloody love Costa Coffee.
Well, because not
I think
anymore.
so she's, that's kind of the point of her article. She's saying, you know, it doesn't feel stuffy.
No.
It feels kind of British and humble and just kind of easy.
It is humble. I mean, it's a bit, as one friend of mine said, shit.
Wait, was that me?
It was, no, shout out to Harry, Mr. Barry Beak. It's that whole thing of you go into a Costa Coffee and it is trying to do some weird kind of hipster thing. As I think I pointed out to you in probably on the fifth trip into Costa, you know, it's got all these kind of woodwork, strange decorations on the walls and screen print, but it's not good. You know, it's mismatched furniture. It's kind of felt and weird scratchy things, but it's trying to almost look a little bit independent.
Yeah, absolutely.
But also homely and down to earth.
So. It's the most corporate thing ever because it's trying to not look corporate by looking like some sort of artisanal space, but in doing that, it just doesn't pull it off and still feels incredibly corporate to me.
No, and for that reason as well, that's why it doesn't feel intimidating, I think, anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I think one important thing to acknowledge is the placement that Costa Coffee had with Coronation Street in 2018. Coronation Street is, I think, Britain's longest running soap on TV.
Yeah.
And it's also about down-to-earth working class people, you know, the everyday ordinary lives.
So Costa was on Coronation. No, it had a tie-in, a sponsorship.
It had a tie-in. I think it was Costa Coffee and the Co-op, the cooperative.
Another again. Solid British institution.
Yeah, the People's Supermarket. I think basically it was meant to be some kind of revolutionary placement deal because actually for the first time, I think this was anyway, it wasn't about just being advertised, you know, between episodes, but it was actually featuring within the show itself. So as a shop with posters on the wall or branded products, you know, Costa was essentially in Coronation Street.
And by virtue of that, was in our hearts.
In our hearts, yeah.
You know, it was a real coming home moment.
Where's Hovis bread music again?
But yeah, that's it, right? So there's been various moments in the life of Costa in which it's become this huge monolithic entity. Again, just like back to the stats at the start, bigger than McDonald's, bigger than Greg's. Mm. And yeah, like things like that featuring on Coronation Street, it's basically found its way into the national psyche.
Yeah, and I think it's important to maybe note as well the comparison with a brand like Starbucks, for example, which does seem very American and sparkly, or as you said, kind of a little bit of the intimidating Cafe Nero or the specialist or smaller coffee shops. And then you have Costa Coffee, which is kind of, you know, it's a bit bland, but it will
so
do.
Is Britain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're okay with that, or are we?
Back to the third space thing just quickly. One thought I had about Costa Coffee, because this really gets to it for me, is like, for me, I don't find the coffee very good. And I'm not sure I would be able to distinguish between a machine having made that coffee and a human being having made that coffee, no matter how much that human being likes making it. Because when we met some of the employees in our Vox Pop Costa crawl, pretty much everyone we spoke to was really nice.
Lovely people.
Yeah, and there was a couple of guys who were really passionate about their job and really passionate about customer service. And the exchange exchanges that they had were really meaningful and really, they were really sweet guys.
Mm.
But in terms of the coffee itself, like, I honestly think you couldn't tell the difference. And what I used to think was that wages in this country are so low that it's probably easier to get a human being to make you the coffee than it is to get them a machine. Clearly, why people go there is this third space thing. And the thing that you were just saying is a space that doesn't put anyone on edge, that makes people feel relaxed. And you really can just kind of be there for ages, right?
Well, I mean, the aircon in the Camberwell site was a little bit cold for my liking. But other than that, yeah. And you've got a bowl of coffee to sit with for an hour.
Yeah, a huge soup bowl of coffee.
A soup bowl of coffee, yeah.
Brass tacks, though. What's the cost of a Costa?
For a latte, you're paying £4.10.
It's pricey, man.
That is pricey.
I mean, the prices change depending on where you are, right? So it's going to be a bit more expensive in London. So don't be messaging in being like, it's a bit cheaper. Yeah, it's £4.10 in London. Maybe it's a little bit cheaper where you live. So let's compare that. So I'm just pulling this up now. The cost of a latte in Starbucks, £4.15. Do you know that's how?
5p more.
5p more, yeah. This is in London again. Cafe Nero, have a guess.
£4.25.
This is funny because this is the thing we were saying.
But like, it's cheaper.
It's cheaper.
Oh my God. You know what? I should have known that.
You should have known that. All this research.
Take back the title. You know what? No, I'm a Costa expert.
You're a Costa
not
expert.
Not Cafe Nero.
Yeah, we're not expecting you to know anything about Cafe Nero. So Cafe Nero is £3.70. So In spite of its air of sophistication, it's £3.70. To be fair, they're probably using a fair bit less milk, I'm going to say. Pret a manger. What do you reckon?
I don't know, but I love a Pret.
Pret latte. Where is it? Higher than Costa or less than Costa?
I want to say £3.75, but now I feel that's a lot.
You've got it.
Bang
on.
Have I got it? Yeah. I visit Pret a lot. I mean, there's so many. If we want to talk about high street chains.
Your expertise have been restored.
Yeah.
But that's the funny thing, because you know the places that in our mind, in our confused mind in this country, I think, about class. You know, we see something like an artisanal coffee shop, right? And we think and we say, oh, that's a bit posh. Costa, you never say Costa is a bit posh, right?
No.
It's the most expensive one. You go to the artisanal coffee shop next to my house and it's £3.50 for a latte. And I know that because that's the same price of all the coffees they do. And I bought a flat white from there before. And it's £3.50. So that's cheaper than Costa. It's cheaper than Pret. Mm. It's cheaper than Cafe Nero. But that's the one that we see as posh, right?
Yeah.
This country's well confused when it comes to things like class, but we're putting that to one side because it's a whole different story. So I think we've covered a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the last thing I want to get into is just Costa's reputation when it comes to their ethics. I mean, coffee in general has it's a murky thing. And I don't know if we really need to get into all of that because Jonathan Morris covers it really well in his podcast, as we've said before. But yeah, there's cost of basically growing coffee is labor intensive. It often comes from small scale farms. It often is really exploitative. But I think more recently they've kind of got themselves in a bit of hot water, or maybe they did that on purpose. Hot water, not a bad link.
See what you did there.
And that was over, I guess there's a bit of a culture war issue. There's over some pro-trans, can we say? Like imagery in one of their campaigns, is that right?
Yeah, so what it was is they had an advert on the side of their bus, or it was part of a bigger mural for, I believe it was Pride Month, which basically featured a person with top surgery.
So that's when you've had a double
mastectomy, so both breasts have been removed.
Yeah.
And there was a whole thing with right-wing media, for example. Lawrence Fox, everybody's favourite person, basically said, you know, they criticised it. They were said that they were promoting, you know, trans imagery and that it was offensive to women and to breast cancer survivors or people who had breast cancer.
This sounds a bit like when Greggs did a vegan sausage roll.
No, we love that.
Yeah. I know I'm always referencing Greggs because, I don't know, big fan. But, you know, and Piers Morgan spat one out live on TV. Piers Morgan, again, did a show about this. So let's hear a clip from that.
That
little sign that showed a double mastectomy. I mean, I could care less.
It was
less.
Grotesque, it was abusive, it was exploitative.
Oh,
it was the most revolting thing I can think I've seen in an advertising campaign.
Why were you
celebrating the mutilation of healthy breasts?
Awful. Why were you so offended, Richard?
I was offended because I just thought it was awful. My other half, Isabel, was appalled by it. And we just told it as we see it. And I think Costa will deeply regret that.
Were you offended, Ava?
Not at all. Not at all. And also, there's no indication to show that that is supposed to be a depiction of someone who is trans.
What else is it?
That could just be someone who has had a double mastectomy, which is quite common. I really don't mind that at all. I just don't think that the coffee there is very good. That's why I don't go there. But...
The thing about this is that, for me, it's like... You know, there's the apart from, you know, I think probably Costa's supply chain is quite murky and people producing the beans from them from all over the world, by the way, blended by this guy with a really rich mouth. Blended by this geezer with a really highly insured mouth. And then we also know things like the milk supply that they get. I mean, as a vegan, this must be close to your heart.
I couldn't look into that one. I left that one to you.
Well, yeah, it's pretty gruesome. I mean, Google if you want to see it. But, you know, there was some undercover investigation of a dairy farm that was supplying Costa a lot of its milk. And the scenes are gross. Yeah, really gross. Just, you know, cows being beaten and cows with ginormous inflamed udders and cows unable to move and that kind of stuff. So I don't for one minute really think that this is a company that is particularly ethical. And I think... that they are making a lot of profit, clearly, out of their dominance in a very popular market. And so, while, you know, they might be doing some kind of progressive stuff around this on an image level, it also has the feeling of being what people call like pink washing. So, like making your company seem more ethical than it is, you know, in reality, you know. All right, let's leave it there. Gemma, that was super, super interesting. After the break, Forrest DLG and myself are going to speak to Maxwell Colliner Dashwood, who is the founder of Colliner Coffee, the author of several books on coffee and a 3-time UK barista champion. So a bit of an expert. That's after the break. We're also going to taste test some of Max's boutique coffee, and we're going to taste test some Costa coffee as well. And then we'll conclude the episode with some final thoughts on why Costa is the UK's favourite coffee shop. Gemma, why is it?
Mediocrity.
You don't think that at all? You're a massive fan.
I don't know, not anymore after 7 bloody visits. Then I went to Liverpool and went to another one.
Keen.
Vegan ham and cheese toastie was pretty good though.
You're listening to the Full English Podcast. And as you know, we make this show for love and not for money. In fact, to make each episode, I have to beg, borrow, or steal equipment. So if you'd like to help us make this show, then go to patreon.com/fullenglish and just sign up for £3 a month. That's obviously less than the price of a Costa coffee, but it means the world to us. That's patreon.com/fullenglish. Over now to Maxwell Colliner Dashwood, whose boutique coffee shop, Colliner & Smalls, has recently opened on Lever Lane in central London.
Very good.
How are you doing, man?
Dave, nice to meet you.
Awesome. My first feeling of coming in here is it's almost like the antithesis of like a Costa coffee. But not in a bad way, like the kind of thing I would like to go to.
Yeah, so basically... The idea was that when we started, it's 14 years ago we started in Bath, and I got annoyed by the house coffee because it just stopped any conversation. I also created a shop for me, right, which is I wanted to taste lots of coffees and play around with it and talk to customers about it. So I created this menu where the coffees change all the time. So there's like 3 espressos, 3 filter coffees. We also do lungos, and we have a freezer menu here as well, where we have coffees that were super rare that we launched, kept some to one side, roasted it, and then keep it in individual frozen doses so it lasts for longer. But obviously you can see they're sort of more expensive, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think sort of what sets us apart is that commitment to a curated specialist menu.
What's the approach for you if someone comes in and they're used to going to Costa Coffee, Starbucks, Nero, and they come in and they see the menu, kind of feel potentially overwhelmed? They think maybe, ooh, is this actually for me? I kind of like coffee, but I don't know if I like it this much. What? How do you approach that kind of person?
So it's okay if you want to leave, you can.
So it's not really, it's not for them.
The when we hire people, and I, you know, so many baristas or people working in cafes are used to serving. So you literally wait, it's very, you just react, right? The customer's in full control. They're like, I want a flat white. That menu, you see there's no menu of like flat white espresso. Mm. We got rid of that as well, right? Because that creates a predefined narrative of how people talk and engage with coffee. So, but I say to the staff, like, we have to be a host, right? And if the things we do, like, they create, I would say, hopefully positive friction.
So, like, let's say, you know, like, my mom comes in. I'm sorry, mom, if you're listening, I'm picking you. And it's like, I would like a latte, please. And then the front of house here are just like, they ask them kind of what kind of coffee they want, or how do they guide them through that process?
You'd always start with a positive. You'd be like, absolutely, we can make you a latte, yeah. Right? It's the three coffees on the right-hand side. So the coffees change every week. They're from interesting producers. They will taste a bit different to traditional coffees. My favorite coffee right now is the Kenyan coffee. Actually, even though it's quite an acidic coffee, it's really sweet in milk. Do you want to give that a go?
Wow, you're very good at this. I would say yes. I think my mum would say yes. I'll take my money.
Instantly comfortable.
I think we'll go to Costa in a minute, but maybe before we go, we should buy a coffee here and then we can compare. Yeah. But can you guide us through the process? Because I am a little bit scared.
Do you want something with milk or do you want something black?
I normally drink black coffee.
Cool. So it's basically strength. Do you want something sort of more delicate or something more intense?
I'll go for delicate. This is good. Cool. I like this guide.
Go intense.
Great.
Just for the contrast.
So I think what would be good is if you both do the same coffee, the Mutero AA from Kenya, it's a washed coffee. That means they fermented it in water. So it should be like clean and fruity and acidic. We'll make one as a Lungo through the machine, which is like between espresso and filter strength, and one as a filter coffee, which is more delicate.
Nice. I'm excited.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you get that, Izzy?
Got that.
How was your coffee, Dave?
Gorgeous, man. Yeah, really, really light.
You got them the wrong way around, didn't you?
Oh,
really?
Well, I mean, I think we...
You said delicate.
I said delicate. Yeah, I
thought it was quite strong.
I think, yeah, we were...
It's delicious. I'm loving it. It is. I'm glad I got the delicate one.
That one's nice. It's like super punchy and quite sharp. Yeah, and then finishes really smooth. Yeah. This is just like... Yeah, calm.
And obviously, the fact you're having it black is interesting as well, right? Because... You know, our whole supply chain is based on black coffee. Mm-hmm. You know, the farmers taste it black, the importers taste it black, the roaster we taste a lot black. And then, but you know, somewhere like the UK, it's as much a milk industry as it is a coffee industry. You know, a lot of coffee is going to be added, have milk added to it. I mean, the famous one is instant coffee, right? Which is, it's reduced, and people talk about, oh, you know, instant coffee's reducing, less people are drinking it, but it's still massive. It's still like 75% of all coffee consumed is instant. Yeah, it's crazy.
Shall we then go and try some Costa coffee and do a comparison?
Sure, yeah, I can give you thoughts.
Yes, please. Can I have one flat white and one Americano, please?
Flat white and Americano.
Yes, please.
Right, so we've got like a go-to drink with milk, and then I guess you got the black coffee because it's like we can taste the roast.
I want to talk about the coffee, and obviously the easiest way to do that is to taste it black.
Okay, well, let's do it.
Me do. Well, the flat white is obviously quite a bit bigger than, you know, a real coffee nerd would argue this isn't even a flat white.
That's the first thing I noticed in Costa, is just like they love giving you milk. There's so much of it.
And I think for specialty coffee, we roast a bit lighter, so less milk helps too. Because, you know, if you're going to have big drinks with loads of milk, you need a darker roast to cut through the milk, so it still tastes of coffee, right? Okay, so I'm going to start with the flat white. It's pretty hot. It's probably a little bit too hot. There's also, that's a preference thing, but in specialty, a lot of people are trying to heat the milk to about 60 degrees. I think it's probably a bit more like 75, 80. It tastes kind of like coffee, right? That sounds outrageous. You have all these flavor notes that obviously at the boutique end, which I get a bit funny about flavor notes. Can you really taste blackberry? No. Like, it's just, you're trying to describe what makes that different, right? But, you know, if you say, well, coffees can be fruity or floral or earthy or spicy, this is, you know, very much down the middle. The flavors are, there's definitely not fruit or high acid. I think what's really interesting about coffees like Costa, or I think about Gold Blend all the time, right? Coffee geeks become so excited, passionate, and over time love what we do,
that we then also assume or tell this story that commercial coffee is really bad. But you wouldn't have millions of people drinking it if it was really bad, right? It's actually just inoffensive.
The other thing you have to appreciate is both these drinks I'm drinking now, I'm drinking without sugar. And, you know, a huge sum of the people who buy these drinks are going to add sugar. And so we've always had this challenge with our coffees, right? If they're aromatic and acidic, those coffees you had earlier, you put sugar in them, they taste weird. They can often go a bit sour. Whereas obviously in this case, this would take sugar absolutely fine. You know.
And are you also tasting the milk? I mean, like, not all milks are made equal, right?
No, 100%. So like, you know, if you want to take it to the, you know, if you want to get really geeky about it, people turn up at World Barista Championships where they fed a single cow a certain diet to achieve a certain milk, right? Yeah, I know, right? If that doesn't get you the win, I don't know what does, right? But yeah, this flavour is what I would expect from a commercial milk. Like, again, you know, it's not farmy or anything like that you get from these independent milks. It's, you know, almost like a, tastes like a soft serve or something, right? Like, sounds weird because it's milk's white, but it tastes white.
It's neutral, basically. Neutral. Yeah, but we could even say that what we're tasting, Britain's favourite coffee, by volume and by voting, apparently, by polling, is kind of bland.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that, yeah. Huh. Yeah, that would be, that's like, they've done their job well, I think, if they can achieve that, right? Because, in a, you know, you're big, you're having to source loads of coffee from different origins, and to get that result repeatably, consistently, is actually quite a challenge. So, you know, I think if you're in the Costa team developing this product, you know, you probably wouldn't use the word bland, but like, you know, balanced, repeatable, like no flavour taints, no inoffensive flavours from problems with the beans, just, yeah, absolutely, right down the middle, yeah.
They're working really hard to not appear to be working at all, or to be inoffensive.
I think instant coffee does that too, right? In exactly the same way. So I'm going to taste the Americano now. Again, it's quite a lot of liquid, so a bit like the flat white, it's quite a large drink. Okay, so you do taste a lot more of the roast there. You like, it is more astringent, it is more bitter. It's very low on acid. It's very low on acid. Kind of a bit cocoa-y, a bit woody, a bit tobacco-y. So it's all those low tertiary flavours. I do think, like we discussed before, very few people will drink it straight black, and if they do, they'll have sugar in it. So there isn't a lot of sweetness in this, but, you know... Again, I think a lot of people would get that sweetness by adding sugar. Again, though, like, you know, I taste a lot of coffee. Yeah, like, it is quite balanced. It isn't very offensive.
So, again, it's like, yeah, it's just the platonic ideal of, it's neutral.
There's this whole thing about, like, comfort versus exploration, right? This isn't just coffee. This is, like, life, or, like, especially all food, right? And that, you know, a lot of people just want... what they know, there's like they associate something familiar and comforting with, you know, a caffeinated beverage that tastes how you expect it to taste, right? Whereas then in my end, the boutique end, you know, yeah, some of them are surprising, some of them are quite fermented, some of them are more floral, and you know, people aren't necessarily up for that. And I think Costa would definitely feel like it's trying to offer a coffee shop experience, and the coffee is the vehicle, right? It's the, in this context, the coffee is the mechanism for this sitting around a table and chatting or delivering caffeine, and actually the flavour side of it is far less primary.
You've been listening to The Full English, and this show has been all about why Britain is in love with Costa Coffee. And what I take from all of this is that Costa owes its success to its vast expansion and its domination of our social and our domestic environments. Clearly, when we contrast Costa to a boutique coffee shop like Maxwell's or any independent coffee shop, we see how there's something deeply unchallenging and therefore kind of comforting about Costa. In fact, there's something weirdly anti-continental about this brand established by Italian migrants. And I think in Britain, we live in a world in which corporate blandness is our default position. What Costa offers makes us feel safe and familiar, and that in turn makes Costa an important third space where we can relax, share conversation, and enjoy a ritualistic caffeine hit. Costa is inarguably and comfortably bland, and so too, in a way, is Britain. Full English is produced by me, Lewis Bassett. Gemma Greenwood researched and co-presented this episode. Forest DLG provided the music, editing, and the mixing. To support this show, visit patreon.com/fullenglish.